Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended. With 16 locations, including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. It's a pretty special day for a pair of Williamston High School students. Julie Hsu and Spencer Otterson have been at work for a while on their project, and it's grabbed an awful lot of people's attention. And today, it gets the attention of President Barack Obama at the White House. Julie Hsu and Spencer Otterson, and we want to acknowledge them at the top of the show. They've worked really hard, and they got a lot of really bright kids. This is a pretty small club that they are a member of, by the way. This is the third White House Science Fair. 100 students were invited, and only 25 were selected to have a special showing for President Obama. And Spencer and Julie are two of them. So, salute. It's Earth Day here, the 22nd day of the month, 4/22/13, and it's been 2.5 years since an oil pipeline owned by the Canadian company Enbridge ruptured near Marshall, spewing hundreds of thousands of gallons of heavy crude oil into the Kalamazoo River. It's been one of the costliest oil spills in U.S. history, and the cleanup is still ongoing. Steve Hamilton is an MSU scientist who's been monitoring the cleanup, and he joins us by phone from Kalamazoo to give us an update. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning.
Remind us what happened in the Enbridge spill a couple of summers ago. How bad did it get?
Well, a pipeline that carries this kind of oil, which is coming from Western Canada, and we call it tar sands often, or oil sands, crosses through Kalamazoo County, and it developed a rupture, and that was in a place where it was buried underground under a small wetland, which was connected to a small stream. And the oil gushed out for a long time before it was noticed, and it made its way into the small stream and then into the Kalamazoo River, ultimately contaminating up to 40 miles of the river.
So remind us, this is not a conventional crude oil as people typically think of it, correct?
That's right. And there's a lot of confusion in the media right now about the name of this material. But what it is oil sands, crude, or bitumen is a better word for it, or sometimes it's called bitumen, and it's thick like molasses at normal temperature, and they have to use heat or chemicals even to get it out of the ground, out of the sand in which it's found. And in order to pump it through a pipeline, they have to dilute it with lighter petroleum compounds, and so hence we call it diluted bitumen when it's in the pipeline.
And where are we now, 2.5 years into this cleanup?
Well, it's going to continue this summer, unfortunately, and the reason is that the submerged oil has proven very difficult to deal with. And this is the first spill of this material on this scale in an inland freshwater river, and the largest one in North America, actually. And we're learning that a significant fraction of this material sinks and becomes integrated into the sediments. And that's been the most difficult part to clean up. There was also a very large amount that was deposited on the riverbanks and floodplain, but at least you could see that, and so you could go strip the vegetation and scrape the soils or whatever it took to get rid of that. But the submerged oil is the problem that continues.
What do we know now that we didn't know, say, 6 months ago? I mean, have we learned recently that the situation is possibly worse than we thought, say, a year or two ago?
Well, the main way that we have to screen for the presence of submerged oil is to go out in a boat and literally stick a pole down in the sediments and disturb them and wait for a sheen to come up and look at how much sheen appears. And sometimes you get tiny globules of oil as well that float on the surface.
Huh.
That's temperature dependent, so we weren't able to study it over the winter here, waiting for the water to warm up to do a spring reassessment. But we did a lot of work, and when I say we, it's actually the contractors that Enbridge is paying under direction of the EPA. I'm just independently advising the EPA on the cleanup. So anyway, the spring and fall assessments of last year showed that there is still a lot of sheen production, in particularly three areas behind dams where the river slows down and material naturally settles out and accumulates.
So you are still discovering areas where there is this oil that you hadn't gotten to before.
Well, that's true, and we're also discovering that the oil is persisting in places that have already been cleaned up.
Hmm.
And so one idea is that new oil is still in the system coming down river and settling out in these quiet places.
What's on the short-term future here then? As the weather warms up here, how much does the cleanup company and how much does Enbridge and the EPA all want to get done here while during this window of opportunity when the weather is warmer?
Right. So the EPA issued an order to Enbridge calling for further cleanup or recovery of the submerged oil in these three hot spots behind dams. And the EPA's strong suggestion, is that dredging is the best way to address the problem at this point. In other words, physically remove the upper layer of the sediments, take it up on land, try to get the water out of it, and then take it, to a landfill, basically.
What are the risks involved in dredging?
Well, dredging is extremely disruptive, of course. You suck up the bottom with everything that lives there. And so it's disruptive in that way. It can produce plumes of suspended sediment, although with a lot of measures to control that, that might be less of a problem. It's also a lot of heavy equipment on the river, and they need a staging area on land, and it's really expensive. And so nobody wants to dredge unless it's kind of a last resort, I guess you could say, to deal with a problem like this.
Well, let's be absolutely clear. Are you saying dredging's been proposed or dredging is definitely going to be moved on? Dredging will happen.
So EPA issued the order. Enbridge said that they were intended to comply with the order. And I think the last stage, and I don't know if it's actually how close it is the permitting by the State Department of Environmental Quality. So I would expect to see dredging.
As an independent scientist, Steve, how would you assess the EPA's response to this episode?
Well, I think the EPA's response has been very good. They came in very early on, and I think the response has been pretty much by the book, the way the laws have been written to handle this kind of a situation. So I think it's been excellent. It's not been easy, but I can't point to something that they should have done that they didn't do overall.
What about Enbridge's?
Well, I think for the first half of the cleanup, I would say the same thing, and I think a lot of people would agree. Naturally, they're getting more and more impatient with the situation as time goes on, and less enthusiastic, I guess.
You referred to adequate compliance with the laws. Are the laws themselves adequate, in your view?
Well, I think so. As far as I can tell in this single, case study, the laws are very strong, and they were able to pretty much, tell the company what they needed to do, and the company is, financially responsible for all the expenses that have been incurred at all levels in this cleanup.
It sounds like the Kalamazoo River is pretty much a test case for this intense of a spill with this kind of oil product. Can you point to things that we've learned from the Kalamazoo spill that hasn't been on anyone's radar before?
Sure, and it's a lot of it has to do with the particular kind of material, the diluted bitumen from the oil sands region of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing we learned is that it sticks to surfaces and it's very hard to get off, harder than conventional crude oil. So things like plants and soils and man-made objects that got coated with the oil had to basically be removed to get rid of the oil. Couldn't wash it off. We figured out that the significant part sank. Nobody was sure in the beginning. We knew it was overall denser, a little heavier than conventional crude, but we were all, I think, surprised at how much ended up on the bottom of the river system. And we still don't understand exactly what made it sink.
Are we learning, perhaps, how deep this bitumen sinks, or will we be learning that as far as the riverbed goes?
Well, it really sinks down on the surface of the sediment, but the river being dynamic, especially during floods, for example, today, it rearranges those sediments. And so there's that natural process of rearrangement of the sediments, which can actually integrate it in more deeply. And actually, the attempts to clean it up have probably also mixed it with deeper layers. And it's not what you might imagine. You might picture a puddle or a layer, a continuous layer of oil sitting on the bottom. It's not like that at all. It's integrated in an almost microscopic form now into the sediments in tiny globules. Very difficult to actually see when you take, a sediment core and a clear core. You can just barely detect it sometimes, or often you can't see it at all.
That doesn't sound real encouraging. Have you been able to measure changes in the ecosystem as far as its impact on life? Are we that far along?
Well, so the oil that was deposited above the normal summer water level, and the river was really high when it first received this oil, obviously coated a lot of vegetation. It was the middle of the summer. And all that vegetation with visible oil on it was removed, so that was an impact. Of course, it was cut off at the ground surface, though, and a lot of it has come back from the roots, and so it's not like we have a barren floodplain now. It's actually, you know, hard to tell in some places that anything happened, so that part seemed to be very resilient. In the submerged oil areas, the impacts of the dredging and disturbance still persist, so we haven't seen the full return of aquatic plant beds and, you know, clams and things like that you'd expect in those environments.
At this point, Steve, what's at the top of your list of takeaways from the work that's been done so far?
Well, when this kind of oil spills into an aquatic environment, it's very difficult to clean up, and we probably will never be able to completely clean it up, and therefore we need to do everything we can to make sure that doesn't happen. Unfortunately, we just saw it happen again down in Arkansas, and so we need to take stronger measures to make these pipelines safe and to have the best response possible to stop the oil from moving into water bodies.
So there was are you saying there was a bitumen spill in Arkansas in a freshwater river as well?
Well, it actually, the pipe broke in a neighborhood, a suburban neighborhood, bubbled up in people's yards, ran down the street, ultimately went into storm drains and made its way into an arm of a freshwater reservoir and some swamp forest. So it's a smaller scale, but apparently it's as much as a quarter of the volume of oil that spilled in the Kalamazoo River, and it's out there in the environment now, so they're going to have to struggle with the same kind of cleanup.
Steve Hamilton is an MSU professor of ecosystem ecology and biogeochemistry, and he's been monitoring closely the Kalamazoo River ecosystem following the massive Enbridge oil spill 2.5 years ago. Steve Hamilton, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
It's Current State on WKAR. This week, the Michigan State University Department of Geography will host filmmaker Jeff Orlowski for a screening of his documentary, Chasing Ice. The movie documents the work of National Geographic photographer James Balog. Through both film and time-lapse photography, Balog has chronicled the melting of glacial ice.
The initial goal was to put out 25 cameras for 3 years, shoot every hour as long as it was daylight. That would show you how the landscape was changing.
Putting really delicate electronics in the harshest conditions on the planet.
And to mark Earth Day, Current State's Scott Pohl spoke with Chasing Ice director Jeff Orlovsky.
The main goal at the start was this idea that James Balog had. He wanted to do time lapses of glaciers. And he had been designing this equipment. He had built these camera rigs in his garage, and he was going to Iceland. And I got to join on the trip to help him install the cameras and to shoot video. We were shooting video mostly for YouTube videos and promotional materials and just really just to create an archive of what James was doing. We knew that this was something that was special and rare, and we wanted to document it. And it wasn't until probably a year and a half or 2 years into the project that we realized we had the materials to go ahead and start making a film.
One thing I want to make sure that people know about the movie is that Jim Balog and his colleagues went to Greenland, Iceland, and Alaska for this project. But if you think that glacial ice melting is only happening in the polar regions, he also included Glacier National Park in Montana.
It's happening in the lower 48. It's happening in the Arctic and in the Antarctic. It really is happening all around the planet. And what James was trying to do was to create as broad and as comprehensive of a study as he possibly could. You know, scientists had been doing time lapses of glaciers back in the 70s. They were studying glaciers in Alaska with film cameras, documenting them, one photograph every day for, you know, a month in the summertime, something like that. But nobody had ever really done successful multi-year-long time lapses, and nobody had done them as a comprehensive study of the entire Arctic. And James's vision was to go beyond just an individual glacier and really do a broad survey. And that's why the project was called the Extreme Ice Survey. He wanted to see what ice all around the world was doing, and we focused on the Arctic just mostly as a matter of logistics and feasibility.
I'd like to talk a little bit about how the time-lapse photography was achieved, because, of course, that requires that the camera remain still the entire time, and these are these are unfriendly environments. And
Very much so.
There are examples in the film of setups where the camera was blown over or ice or rocks fell on the camera. It took a while to get the cameras set up in a way where they wouldn't seize up. You know, so that it would continue to take photographs despite the cold, for instance. This was quite an undertaking to get the cameras to function for that long while unattended.
You're absolutely right about that. It's something where the technology didn't really exist, and we knew that the conditions were going to be incredibly tough. And James designed, as best as he could, a system that he thought would last. And we tested them in this cold... basically is a freezer. It's a place in Colorado where they store all the ice cores, actually, that they use for these projects, for the scientists to use for this research. And the equipment was tested down at negative 40 and almost negative 60 degrees in these ice core labs, and they performed fairly well. But when you take them out and you put them out in the field, all the variables of being out in the wild for multiple years definitely had an impact on the equipment. And we had lots of unexpected problems that came about with the equipment. But for the most part, within the first year, we had a lot of those things dialed down. We figured out what the weak spots in the system were. We improved some of the technology that was problematic, and it's proven to be very effective.
There's a really powerful sequence in Chasing Ice where a couple of members of the team went out and spent several weeks hoping to be on hand so they could film the calving of a glacier. Now, that's when an enormous chunk of ice breaks away from the rest of the glacier. And the cameras were rolling as one of them was on the phone with James Balog, and the calving started. Let's listen.
I'm on the phone with Jim on one of our regular check-ins. Jim, nothing's happening.
It's starting, Adam, I think. Adam, it's starting.
Right? Look at that. Look at the whole thing.
It turns out that the ice you see breaking away in this scene is roughly the size of Lower Manhattan. It's incredibly huge, and you get to witness the entire process.
Yeah, it is. It's the largest calving event that has ever been documented in high-def video. And it's something where... When Adam and I were there, we were camped out for several weeks, and we had 9 cameras with us trying to capture this exact thing. And we were very lucky that it happened. And we were there waiting for those several weeks for something like this, and we were really thrilled that we were able to catch it. It does bring up an interesting point, though, in that there's this these mixed emotions that we're feeling sometimes. There's the excitement as a photographer of capturing what's going on. And we're there with these video cameras wanting to capture powerful video. But when you look at the footage and you realize what's happening and you realize the significance and importance of it, you have a very different association with the footage. It's this beauty versus horror that we've had to struggle with throughout the entire project.
You'll have to forgive me. I hadn't caught up with the fact that you are one of the guys in that sequence.
Oh, yeah. It's not super clear in the film, but that was me and Adam who were out there. And we maintained a 24-hour vigil. We were there in May. We had 24 hours of daylight, and we knew that the glacier could break off at any time. And we wanted to make sure that somebody was always awake watching the glacier just in case anything happened. And we were up together for 8 hours for dinner every night. I took the night shift up until the early hours in the morning. And then I woke Adam up, and he took the morning shift, and we kept that rotation going nonstop every single day. And somebody was always awake, paying attention. There are times where you're in the tent, it's cold out, and you definitely have the tent door closed, but you're trying to listen. You keep peeking your head out the window, out the door every, you know, half hour, hour or so, and want to make sure that things are, you know, the glacier is still there. But it was quite an experience, that trip.
Now that the movie is out, is James Balog still out there? Is the extreme ice survey still underway?
It is. James is still documenting what's going on. He's traveling around the world to continue his photography. He's installing more cameras in South America and in Antarctica, and we want to keep the record going. Right now, there are about 30 cameras at 16 glaciers, and they shoot every half hour of daylight. The camera checks to see if there's enough light, turns the system on, takes a picture, and goes back into hibernation for the next half hour.
You're visiting Michigan State University's Department of Geography for this screening of Chasing Ice, and assuming you've done this sort of thing before, do you find college audiences to be receptive? Do you sometimes see people who don't subscribe to the theory that climate change is a man-made phenomenon?
We found that the college reception has been very great, very positive. We've done many screenings at universities around the country, and we've done screenings with all sorts of different groups and film festivals, and obviously with our theatrical run as well. The college groups tend to know what's going on. They know the science. They know the reality of everything. And more than anything, I think the film has served to inspire and motivate, you know, people in the scientific field or in the environmental field. It's through some film festivals, or it's through just our regular theatrical release where we've shared the film with audiences who might have been more skeptical about the issue. And those are interesting because the Q&As and the conversations that follow those screenings have a very different tone, where people are asking questions about the science and they're curious to learn more about it. And it's been very fulfilling and satisfying to be able to be there and answer those questions for people and point out, you know, these scientists know what they're talking about. They know the natural cycles, and they're telling us the cycles are not natural anymore. These factors that are causing our current trends in the climate are unnatural. So it's been great to be on the road with the film and to share the information with the public.
Jeff Orlowski is director of Chasing Ice. Thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
The MSU Department of Geography screening of Chasing Ice with Director Jeff Orlowski, 7 p.m. Thursday, room 119B, Wells Hall, Michigan State. Coming up on WKAR's Current State, we update the LBWL's effort to provide juice for Lansing area electric car owners. That's coming up.
So much left to do. If I should run 10,000 miles home.
In 2010, the Lansing Board of Water and Light established its Plug-in Electric Vehicle Community Project with funding from the U.S. Department of Energy. the BWL installed an array of electric vehicle charging stations across the Lansing area to promote this emerging technology. Now, the utility is taking another step toward building an electric car infrastructure. In celebration of Earth Day, officials are dedicating a new solar-powered electric charging station at the new City Market in downtown Lansing. Current State's Kevin Lavery spoke with project manager Angie Goodman about how the BWL is preparing for a day when cars become a normal part of the grid.
It's been a great program. We've had a lot of success with it. We have deployed 22 to 23 electric vehicles, and we've installed over 40 electric vehicle charging stations around the area.
Describe for me, if you will, this large solar panel that is being erected as we speak right next to the Lansing City Market.
We are installing a two-carport solar electric vehicle charging station. There are two ports in there, so we can have two electric vehicles that can charge. It will be able to charge the cars off of sun energy. It does have a backup from our distribution system if needed. Part of our program is to study what the impact of electric vehicles is going to have on the distribution system and try to come up with ways to reduce the impact.
I take it the distribution system is what laymen would call the grid.
Yes, correct, the grid. We want to make sure that our customers are getting the best service they can.
Angie, explain how we believe in this area consumer demand is going to really propel the need for this type of station.
We are actually evaluating which needs to come first, whether it's the charging stations or the electric vehicles, the chicken or the egg. So we worked with getting electric vehicles out there and putting the charging stations in, and we're evaluating how much people charge, what time of day, and where they're charging. We're seeing a definite demand for people wanting to be able to charge. I get calls weekly from people looking at where charging stations are in the area. Can we put them down in public and business locations? More residents calling to find out what it takes to install one at their home.
Do individuals buy them themselves? Do businesses buy them themselves? And how would this replace those?
People do purchase them themselves. Are they required? No. The cars come with a standard 110 charging station that they can use and just plug into a standard outlet at their home. It's a preference. Do you want to be able to charge your car faster? 240 volts going to charge it. Say for a Chevy Volt example, it's going to charge it in 3.5 to 4 hours. The standard plug's going to take 7 to 8 hours. So it's what people are looking for. Businesses are purchasing their own. Now, through our program, which was funded through a federal appropriation, we did provide the charging stations to businesses and to homes.
It's interesting, Angie, how the automotive industry more than 100 years ago sort of began on a similar footing to what's happening now.
Yes, electric vehicles were actually one of the first cars in production. Once they found out that internal combustion engines or gasoline could take you further, they switched over to that. We've now come full circle right back to trying to make electric our means for transportation. It does help reduce our dependency on foreign fuels. We're looking at the renewable energy portion to see how we can be greener and be more sustainable. Being the utility here in Lansing, we need to make sure we can provide the best customer service, and that is the grid. How much energy do we have? If everybody's coming home from work and plugging their cars in at 5 o'clock, we're going to have problems. The distribution systems we need to study, do we need to upgrade transformers? And this same situation happened when air conditioners went out there. It started with a couple on a block, and then it came every house now. If you look, nearly every house, I should say, has an air conditioner in it. Same thing with electric vehicles. Right now, you see them sporadically through town. Eventually, we're going to see an influx, and you're going to see streets that have 3 or 4. So we want to know, is that going to impact the grid, and do we need to upgrade our system?
That statement you said makes me think about the big power failure we had about 10 years ago. I think it was centered in Ohio. Is that part of the Board of Water and Light's thinking, that enough electric cars on the grid means that the grid has to be strong enough to withstand all that?
We are looking at the impact that electric vehicles can have. We are actually working to encourage people to charge off-peak. What off-peak is 11 o'clock at night till 7 in the morning. So we've offered a discounted electric vehicle rate to give an encouragement. The nice thing with electric vehicles is you can come home, plug it in, and set it. The car has a timer in it. So you can plug it in at 5 o'clock, but it won't actually start charging the car till 11 o'clock at night. We have more than enough electricity available for our consumers in the evening hours, and it's a way to distribute the load management.
This carport will only serve 2 cars at a time. Do we expect a time when people will be lining up to get their car charged here?
We do. We expect that there will be a time that we're going to have a higher demand for more charging stations. Right now, yes, this does only hold 2 cars. Early adopters with electric vehicles are actually, they're wonderful. They work together to coordinate. They know if their car is parked in there. They usually try to move it after they're done charging to make sure it is available for other electric vehicles.
So this is the actual charger here right beneath the panels.
Correct. This is a level 2 charging station, which level 2 is a 240 volt. All charging stations now come with the standard plug, which is a J1772. And again, this is hardwired into the electric system. You just pull your car in and plug it in and charge.
I just love J1772s, don't you?
You have to give the numbers. You got to be accurate, right?
It looks almost like a hairdryer.
Correct. I mean, it really does. It is a safety device, though. It has 5 prongs, and until the last prong connects, it's called a handshake. There's no electricity flowing through this, so it is safe for people to touch and handle.
Angie, over here, I can see a Chevy Volt that is owned by the Board of Water and Light. What can you tell me about the car itself?
The Chevy Volt itself, the electric car, does not make any noise, but it does have a very cool startup. Very futuristic sounding. Right now the car is running. There is no sound.
Silence is the sound of the future.
Yes, that is true.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Angie Goodman is the project manager for the Lansing Board of Water and Light's Plug-in Electric Vehicle Community Program. Angie, I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you. It was great talking with you, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. Can genes be patented? That's the question the U.S. Supreme Court is looking to answer in their latest case, for which they heard arguments just last week. The court's ruling could drastically change the biotech industry and also the way universities do research. Jennifer Carter Johnson is an assistant professor of law at Michigan State University. She's an expert in intellectual property law, and she has a PhD in microbiology. She explains to Current State's Emmanuel Berry that the practice of gene patenting started over 30 years ago.
It's been since the early 1980s. There was a case, Diamond versus Chakrabarty, that basically said anything under the sun made by man is patentable. And it was specifically in the context of living things, bacteria that had been changed genetically to be able to degrade oil, oil spills, petroleum-based products. And so while it did not talk about genes specifically, it talked about living organisms. And from there, we've had this explosion in the biotechnology industry, and one of the side effects of that has been the increase in gene patenting. And so the United States Patent and Trademark Office has accepted gene patents, but it's never gone to court as to whether they should be patentable subject matter.
So now it's finally gone to court, all the way up to the Supreme Court. So could you offer us some background specifics on this case? So it's dealing with the gene BRCA1 and 2, mm-hmm. correct? What is that, and what does it have to do with gene patenting?
So BRCA1 and BRCA2 are genes that are found in all of our bodies, but if they're mutated, lead to an increased chance of breast cancer and ovarian cancer, mainly in women, but also in men. And so what has happened is researchers at the University of Utah were the first and among many to actually discover this gene and discover its correlation with increased risk of breast cancer. And they patented this gene and licensed it to Myriad Genetics, who has since further developed it and worked out diagnostic methods so that women can go in and be tested to determine if they have the mutated gene and perhaps have more breast cancer screenings or even prophylactic mastectomies if they do have the mutation that causes the cancer.
So the case is involving, they're saying that this company can't have a patent on this gene. I guess, how does this affect people on a daily basis if you're going in and you want to get tested to see if you have this gene that's correlated with these diseases? How does this affect you because there's a patent on it?
On the most basic level, the patent restricts who can actually run the test, who can run these diagnostic tests. Because Myriad Genetics has the patent on the gene, Myriad can license the right to perform these tests to whoever they want to. So they have complete control as to whether you have access to a particular testing facility. They've licensed it fairly restrictively. Not all they don't take all of the insurance companies that everyone has, so you may or may not have insurance that they will take, so you may or may not have coverage for it. You may have to pay out of pocket for the test. Mm-hmm. So it's basically a restriction as to the access to the diagnostic.
Lay out each side of the argument here. So for people who are saying that we should not be allowed to patent genes, what is their case? What are they arguing?
So the basic argument is that the genes that are being patented are basically the same genes that we have in our body. And so they're a product of nature and should not be patented. So there are two types of patents at issue here. There are the genes that exist exactly as they do in our body and are basically just snipped out and isolated. Mm-hmm. And that's one type of patent gene patent at issue. The second type of gene patent at issue is where the scientists have taken the gene as it exists in our body and have basically just pulled out the coding regions of those genes and put them together. And there's a scientific process that they have to go through that. And we call that cDNA. And that cDNA is also patented. And it's a little bit different than what is actually in the body. And so the basic argument is even that cDNA looks like the gene as it's going about its work in the body, and so it looks very different.
And I remember a lot of people are saying, and it's like saying if you found gold, you can patent it. If you can patent a granola bar, just kind of these out there comparisons. Are those comparisons fair?
They're actually the same comparisons that they used before the Supreme Court. They used the example of if you find a new way to isolate gold, should you be able now to patent gold? And the answer is no, you can't. You might be able to patent the method of isolating gold. You might be able to patent a new use for gold in its new purified form, but you can't patent the gold itself. And that's what the critics of gene patents are arguing. The methods for extracting the genes, certainly patentable. New uses for these genes that are discovered, certainly patentable. But the genes themselves should not be patentable. From a social perspective, not merely a legal one, it's one reason for not patenting genes is that it restricts access to the test, to the basic underlying tests for the gene that involve the genes. Also, it restricts access to the genes for further research. So Myriad has tied up the BRCA1, BRCA2 gene for other researchers to not be able to continue going on. So that's the basic argument as to why we shouldn't be patenting genes.
And for those who are saying we should be able to patent genes, I mean, there's industries based off of this and this idea that you can patent a living organism. What are they saying? Or what is their argument for keeping it the way it is, the system?
Well, their argument is that, as I mentioned, we are actually, there is human ingenuity that it goes into finding the gene and snipping it out. And they actually came about it backwards. They isolated the cDNA, where there is human steps. I said there's several scientific processes that go into isolating the gene, the coding region. And so they took that and then went backwards and figured out what the introns were. And so it looks like what is isolated from the body, but they came about it from the opposite direction. And so their argument is there's a lot of human ingenuity that goes into discovering these genes and actually figuring out the sequencing and all of that. And so if the standard is anything under the sun made by man, they were the ones who actually made these gene constructs. that they're actually trying to patent. And as you said, there are entire industries that are built on this. The biotechnology industry, which leads into the pharmaceutical industry, all of these research streams would be highly disrupted if the patents were no longer allowed.
Why would, I guess what I'm kind of wondering is, part of the reason I think that, that patents exist are, from my understanding, is that it's an incentive. And, you know, people aren't going to pour money in and invest in these, you know, the privatization of these biotech companies if they're not going to get returns on it. I guess, is there any fear or how does the biotech industry survive if this case rules against gene patenting? What happens?
Well, that's exactly the part of the argument from the biotech side, is why would we pour money into a gene if we're not the only ones who can work on it? One thing to realize is that the University of Utah and Myriad were not the only people working on BRCA1. University researchers all across the United States were actually working on this. It was a race to get to the point where it could be patented. Everybody, science is incremental in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there would be a difference in what the biotech industry would be willing to pour money into. But they're still going to be able to patent the uses for the gene. They're not going to be out of every patent. They're still going to have incentives to figure out new uses for genes and new reasons for new methods to extract, and all of that will still be patentable. At the same time, we have grant funding for basic research, and that's where a lot of this research is done to begin with. So you'll have university research all across the country that's now going to be opened up to be able to do more research because they won't have the constraints of patents. And so they'll be able to push the science along to a point where they'll be able to get more patentable more patentable inventions, and then the biotech industry can come in and take those inventions and use those in the patents and those incentives to go forward.
And I wanted to ask you, looking specifically at Michigan State University, we're a research institution. What kind of potential impact does this case have on MSU's bio and ag research here?
Again, it's going to free, if patents are not allowed for these genes, it'll free up the researchers to have much more comfort in what they're doing research on. They're not going to have as much of a fear of patent infringement allegations and those sorts of legal consequences of infringing patents. So I think it should give us more research and more things that we might, more avenues to do research on. On the con side is we also have a technology transfer office here on campus. And so to the extent that we were patenting genes before and licensing those out, we wouldn't be able to do that anymore. So it might actually harm our technology transfer side, or at least push what we're patenting in a different direction. So it'll certainly be something that everyone has to adjust to. But I think there's some good as well as some bad.
So at this point, I know judges don't make the decision until, you know, midsummer, but is there any inclination as to which way they're leaning on this? What's the consensus, I guess, or is there any?
I think, you know, there's a lot of people that go back and forth. I'd say from my reading of the transcript, I'd say that of the two types of patents, my guess, don't hold me to it, is that they're going to say that those isolated DNAs, where it looks just like what's in the gene, what's in the body, but has just been snipped out, those aren't going to be patentable. But the cDNA, where they take what's in the body, they do some of those scientific processes, and then have patent the cDNA, the more condensed form, that still is going to be patentable subject matter. There may still be problems with whether we grant those patents for other reasons, but they're going to be patentable subject matter.
What do you see as the future of genetic copyright law? I mean, is this case going to be the end, or as, you know, we have more scientific advances, more research, are we going to continue to see, you know, this intersection of biotechnology and copyright law crop up in courts?
Do you mean patent law?
Patent law, sorry.
Okay. I think it's going to be a continuing issue. If we allow gene patenting as a base, we're still going to reach some of the other questions of other things that go into granting a patent, like novelty and non-obviousness. So we're still going to have to come back and determine what those look like in the context of gene patents. Plus, there's another case before the Supreme Court right now, which is Monsanto versus Bowman. And in that case, they're looking at patenting of living organisms that are reproducible, so they're self-replicating. And so what impact that has on the patent law. So I think we're not done.
We're not done.
This is just one of many cases that we're going to hear about biotechnology and patent law.
That was Jennifer Carter Johnson. She's an assistant professor of law at Michigan State University. Carter Johnson is an expert in intellectual property law, and she has a PhD in microbiology. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we discuss the environmental impacts of dredging. Also, we speak with Lansing City Council member Jessica Yorko. That and more Tuesday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore, and you've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Douglas J. with two Lansing area salon locations, the Yokomis Salon and Spa and the East Lansing Salon inside the East Lansing Marriott, now offering gift cards for Mother's Day. DouglasJ.com. And by Crip and Volvo, serving the Lansing area for over 40 years. Crip and Volvo sells and services the entire line of Volvos, located on Saginaw Highway just west of I-96. Information at crippen-cars.com.